Welcome to the Driving Sustainable Success in Child Welfare podcast, hosted by the Child Welfare Division of the South Carolina Department of Social Services. This is an intentional space for us to talk together, discover together, and grow together. If you have a passion for serving children and strengthening families, then you have come to the right place.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the second episode of the Driving Sustainable Success in Child Welfare podcast, a product of the South Carolina Department of Social Services. I'm your host, Emily Madeer, Deputy State Director of Child Welfare Services, and we are so glad that you have joined us today. So many of you have given us such positive feedback and have liked and followed the podcast, and we are grateful that you have chosen again to spend this time with us. When I was thinking about what our second episode should be, I knew that I wanted it to build off of our amazing first conversation with Josie Jones, all about our GPS practice model. After talking with some colleagues, we all decided that the topic that we're going to discuss today was the right choice. It's perfectly aligned with GPS and is a foundational practice for child welfare in South Carolina. So today, I am so excited to dive into all things teaming with all of you. Child and family teaming is integrated into every area of our practice in child welfare. And when it's done right and when it's done well, it positively impacts so many different outcomes for children and families. For our conversation today, I'm honored to have Lauren Tinman, our SCDSS Director of the Office of Family and Community Services. After receiving a degree in childhood development from USC, Lauren taught for several years in a Title I school, where she advocated for children and families. Before becoming a teacher, Lauren worked for 6 years as an applied behavioral analyst therapist, serving children from 2 to 13 years old. These experiences, combined with a passion for families and social justice, led her to pursuing a master's degree in leadership and policy. She began her work at DSS as a family engagement liaison and was on the team responsible for developing the entire child and family teaming model that we use today. After leading that program for 2 years, the agency created the Office of Family and Community Services, and Lauren took on the director role. This office is housed within Child Welfare, and it's responsible for all of our prevention services across the state, the implementation of our federal prevention plan, our family voice work, and our child and family teaming. In her free time, Lauren loves to read, hike, and spend time with her friends and family. She stays busy running after her 2 children under the age of 3 with her husband, Spencer. Lauren, welcome.
Thank you so much. I am so excited to be here. It is hard to follow up Josie Jones, but I'll do my best.
We're so glad you're here. We're so excited to talk about teaming. So, Lauren, there's a practice that we have here on the show that helps our audience get to know you a little bit better beyond just your bio that I just shared. So please tell us, what got you into the work of child welfare and what makes you stay?
That's a really good question. And like a lot of people, my path has not been straight. It's been windy. So I have always felt led to work with children and families, but I really found my drive and passion during my undergrad coursework at USC. So I took classes on pedagogy and cultural relevant pedagogy, linguistic pluralism, parent and family dynamics, and these courses all changed the way I saw diversity. It really made me the social justice advocate I am now. So from that point on, I knew that the most important thing I could do in my professional life was to be an advocate for change. Mm-hmm. So throughout my career, I've supported children and families that have experienced or are experiencing trauma and chronic stress. And I knew that although I was making an impact as a teacher, I really wanted to make an even bigger impact by supporting the work of systems that touch these families' lives. So I am so glad that I took that leap of faith to come to DSS because I really, truly love my job. And I enjoy all of the work, the adaptive work, looking at the challenges and creatively coming up with solutions, and the systemic work, the technical work of implementation. I just love it all. So the reason I stay in this job is really because I know the children and families of South Carolina need us.
I love that so much. So I picked up on one thing that you said, an advocate for change. I think that's so powerful. And I think that's probably why a lot of us get into this work and stay in this work, because it's not easy, right? It's hard work. It's challenging work. But we know that we have the potential to be an advocate for change to help children and families experience better.
Yeah, and I think prevention, like I have such a passion for children and families and prevention. And I think about that classroom, right, when I was a teacher. And I think if those families had the resources that we're building now at DSS, perhaps they wouldn't have been in that situation. And I often think about my classroom experiences, my experiences in the home with a lot of families that had very challenging behaviors. And all of those experiences combined are kind of how I draw on those now in my work. So
I love that. So let me dig in a little bit more on something you said about prevention. So there may be people in our audience who don't know what prevention means or may not work in child welfare. So tell us a little bit more. What does prevention mean?
Yeah, so prevention, there's different types of prevention, right? There's primary, secondary, tertiary. When you think of primary prevention, we're really thinking of going to the doctor and staying healthy so that when you get to the, you don't get to the point of having a disease. When you think of secondary prevention, you think of maybe you already have a form of disease or something happening that you need to start kind of curbing. So you're putting things in place to support getting better, right? And then tertiary is really when we're already kind of down the road and we really need more assistance and the disease is already there.
Mm. Yeah. Okay. So we have three different kinds of prevention is what I hear you saying. So primary prevention is making sure that something doesn't happen. So right. In our field, right, it would be before we even get to the point of abuse or neglect occurring, making sure that we can implement a service to help strengthen a family, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So give me an example of maybe what a secondary prevention might look like in our work.
Yeah. So I think a secondary prevention could be something like a plan put in place to help the family who's already involved with the agency that already has some challenges and we already have an investigation or a family preservation case, but a plan to support them with the work that we're doing to really strengthen their family system so mm-hmm. that they don't perhaps have the child removed from the home, right? So they can keep the family in place, support the family in their home. I think that would be a good example of a secondary service.
Great. And we're building all of these services, yeah. right? Across the entire rate. That's really cool.
Yeah.
And that's completely new for South Carolina.
I know. It feels like a big chunk to bite off at one time because I think, we always struggle with how much we can really provide as far as the money that we have available with the services that we know families so desperately need. But I'm so excited because I feel like in the past, we haven't had the opportunity to provide services like this. And it really, instead of maybe treating the issue or the presenting problems, it gets to the underlying cause of the issues and the problems. And that's really exciting, right? Because that's the kind of work that I wanted to get into when I started
that.
My work. So
yeah, so you're being an advocate for change. To help us make sure that we're helping families as early as possible so that we can make sure they have what they need.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Really powerful. So I think let's start talking about teaming.
Okay. Yeah.
So I think maybe the perfect place for us to start is to talk a little bit about how teaming relates to our last topic of the GPS practice model. So could you share with us a little bit about what that connection might be?
Yeah. So teaming is one of the six core practice skills in our GPS practice model. I know you guys heard from Josie last time. She's so amazing and was a great partner in building the CFTM program. And it's so important that we team throughout our work with children and families, and not just children and families, but your colleagues, all of the people that you work with, you can team together for the best outcome. So although we're going to talk about child and family teaming, I think we should also stretch ourselves to think about how could I team with my coworkers?
I love that. Yeah. So teaming can happen at any stage in the work, right? It doesn't have to be a formal meeting. It can happen with a staffing could be an example of teaming.
Yeah, that's a really good example. And all coming together. Really, the whole point of teaming is to come together and it's a solution-focused meeting, right? So whether that's coming together with staff members and thinking about solutions to an issue that's in your office, or if it's coming together with a family that you're serving and getting the right people at the table to help make those decisions.
Very cool. Okay. So I think we have a general framework of what a team or what a child family team might be, but let's go into a little bit more detail. So let's start with the child family team. So what is specifically a child and family team and what does that look like in practice?
Yeah, so a child and family team is a group of people who are family driven. They're thinking about the goals and problem solving processes that families can make together along with the department. They come together with invested stakeholders, maybe a GAL, another provider, the case manager, and really build on the family's strengths to ensure the child's safety, permanency, and well-being.
Mm, that's good. So it's having the family be central
mm-hmm.
and making sure that the family could drive the decision-making.
Exactly. Their voice is paramount, right? We sometimes say, no decision about me without me, and that's for families and children. So I love CFTMs because they actually incorporate a lot of our guiding principles individualized, strengths-based, family-centered, trauma-informed, and culturally responsive. They're all right in a CFTM. So that's really exciting.
That's awesome. So what is a CFTM, or how does a CFTM rather come together? Like, how does it start? And how do you know who should be included?
Yeah, so I think the first way that you might know who, when you need a CFTM, let's start there. So you know you need a CFTM when something's going on in the case that needs a group of people to come together and help come up with solutions. So it might be that a placement is unstable with a foster parent and they're asking for help and they keep reaching out to the case manager. Hey, you know, little Emily is about to have to leave my home. I don't know what to do. I'm throwing my hands up. And they, the case manager can call a CFTM and say, hey, what are some supports that we could put in place to help this family? Or it could look like that's, you know, in foster care, or it could look like a family preservation case where mom is, you know, complaining or having trouble or she needs help. And we are all coming together to say, what are some family members that could support you? What are some services that might be able to help you, you know, with your case? And I think it's really thinking about who could help with that problem, right? So whether that's a service provider or a GAL or maybe a pastor that's really supportive in their church or a friend down the street, but we're all coming together to kind of create a network of support.
Mm. So it's, we talked a little bit in the last podcast about a safety net. So it seems like the team, the child and family team, is that family's safety net.
Yeah.
So it could be their neighbors, like you said, it could be maybe a coach at school if they're engaged in sports or a teacher that they're close to. I love the idea that we keep coming back to around it takes a village, right? It takes a village to support a family. And that seems like what teaming's really about too.
Yeah. And I think if you think about our, like everyone's life, right? Mm-hmm. Like in, I think we all have a village that supports us. I know, like you said, I have two kids under three. There's no way I could lead my life without the support from my mom and my dad and my in-laws. And so that kind of natural support is what we're trying to build on for our clients and the families that we work with.
I love that. Anything else you want to say about how we know who should be there? So if I'm a frontline case manager, how do I go about starting to find out who might be a part of my family's team that I'm working with?
Yeah, so you can ask, right, like the family that you're working with, who's important to you, who would you call if there's a problem, who comes to Christmas, who's at Thanksgiving, right? Those are some good questions to start kind of diving into it. You could look back in dictation and think about like, hey, somebody came up that when we did family finding that would be supportive. I think it's really diving deep and investigating who is a support to that family. And it could be that, you know, there's been cases recently where we've looked back at dictation and there was a coach involved that hadn't been involved in the case recently. But when we called him, he's like, yes, I want to support little Billy, right? Like, of course I'd be there. So I think when we think about who should be there or who could be there, we shouldn't ever count anyone out. We should always ask, right, first.
So. Yeah, I love that. So never count anyone else. Always ask. And always keep asking, it seems like, too, right? So it's not a one-time thing that your team is set from the beginning. It's something that can be continually evolving and that can keep growing however the family needs it to.
That's right. And I think when you think about your own life, again, like we make that parallel to my life 5 years ago didn't have half the people that that I have in it now, right? Like I went to a different church. I didn't. So I think we always have to kind of keep looking at what that safety net looks like.
Yeah, that's great. That's really great. So let's talk about best practice and how teaming integrates with best practice. So if we want to promote best practice in child welfare, if we want to do the best that we can for children and families and make sure that we're those change agents that you talked about earlier, why is teaming important to accomplish that?
That's a good question. So we know that children and families involved with our system, they deserve to have voice and choice in their planning process. And each family is unique. So it's important that we really see them as experts in their planning process. We don't know what works for their family, right? Like they know so what's worked before, they know what hasn't worked before. And so when we ask them to come to the center of the planning and to really honor and respect their voice, they're more likely to work towards their goals. So it reminds me a little bit of, you know, when you were in high school and they were like, you need to read To Kill a Mockingbird. And you started reading, and you're like, this is not what I want to read. I don't want to do this. I didn't choose this. It's a really simple example, but it makes me think of what, you know, when we create our own goals, when we have our own choice, we're more likely to follow through with those things. And I think giving our families a voice and choice in this process is just so important. It shows that we care and sets the precedent that we value your thoughts, your ideas, your input. And and we want you to be successful. We don't want to have a case open for years, right? Like that's not our goal. So I think that shows from the beginning that we're committed to having their input.
Wow. So what that's bringing up for me as I listen to you is this is really a fundamental shift in how we view our work with families, right?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
It's changing that traditional power dynamic. So, you know, in the past, old casework practice, usually I, as the case manager, was telling you as the family what to do. And it seems like teaming really turns that on its head, and it puts the family in the driver's seat to be able to determine what their plan looks like with the support of the child welfare team, of the system around them.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think in the past, we've maybe created cookie cutter plans where where we have the same services, right? Yeah. Like they're going to go to parenting for this amount of weeks and then they'll just be done, right? And I think that kind of mentality is missing the point. Mm-hmm. We're missing the point of really thinking about what families need, because if we're giving every family on our caseload similar services, then we're not really looking at their true needs and matching their need to a service. And so that's where prevention services come in and the services that we're building on our service array. But this all works together, right? Like planning, assessing, the CFTM, all the work that we do is one cohesive, it's not just CFTMs, it's not just CANS and FAST, it's not just the GPS. This should all work together.
So it's really just so integrated and it all just flows together to produce what is best practice and what is the foundation of child welfare.
Yeah, I totally think that's true. Yeah,
that's great. So let me talk a little bit about how teaming relates to our work with teens, because we know we have about a third of our population in foster care are teenagers. We also have a large percentage in our non-custodial cases that are also teens. So working with teens is something that sometimes people feel uncomfortable with, but it's such a large part of our work. So how have we seen implementation of CFTMs improve our work with teens and making sure that they specifically have voice and authority while they're in foster care or while they're involved with the system?
Yeah, I said earlier, no decision about me without me. And when, you know, we think about one of our true principles in child and family teaming is to have the child at the meeting. Now, there are certain circumstances where it's not developmentally appropriate or they're under a certain age. And it may look different depending on the age of the child, right? They might come in for a little bit, and then when it gets maybe a little bit more tense, they might have to leave, or maybe they don't want to come for the whole time and they bring a drawing or their voice recorded, right? But for teens, I think it's paramount to have them there. And this is why. One of the reasons is because they are going to be adults soon, right? And so they know who their system of support is. They know what they want. Mm-hmm. They know where they may be maybe running to or running from, or all of those things, I think, make it so important to have their voice and to have them there, really. Because when we put them at the center and allow them to express their opinions, their desires, we really become solution focused. And that kind of leads us to creative thinking and thinking outside the box. So I think having a child present at a CFTM is so important, but even more so when they're teenagers.
That's really powerful. Have we seen CFTMs impact any other part of our systems or how we coordinate with systems outside of DSS?
Yeah, I think one really exciting thing about CFTMs is there aren't many other avenues to have other agencies come in and collaborate with us, right? Like often we feel like we're on the front lines alone, you know? And I think one exciting thing about CFTMs is you can have a provider there, right? You could have the therapist there. You could have the guardian ad litem. You could have other state agencies that might be able to support in other ways that we haven't thought of. And bringing everyone together in this meeting really could help identify those solutions and creatively think about how we could support the child and the family.
Yeah. So not only is it an avenue to have those people at the table, but it's probably a better meeting because of it, right? Because you have more resources, more support, more minds, more solutions, all with the same goal of just helping the child or the family.
That's right. Yeah. And having the kid there too, that reminded me, having the child or youth there keeps the whole group, right? Like if you think about this group of 10 people and they're all kind of have their own thing that they're bringing in, right? Like one is like, okay, I'm the mom. The other one might be the therapist. The other one might be the guardian ad litem. Having the youth there or their voice there keeps everyone focused on why we're there, right? Yeah. Like we're not here to argue. We're not here to, you know, put our own personal things out on the table. We're really here to support this youth. And every time I see a facilitator bring the meeting back to the youth, it totally changes the whole meeting. And so I think it's important to think about how we can keep them at the center of the conversation.
Yeah, that's so powerful. So I think a few things that I've heard you say is it's about the child and the family, right? That we need to keep it centered on them, letting them drive the meeting and drive the plan. And then also let's make sure that we bring as much support for the family as possible. Make sure that we build up that village or that safety net for the family to help them have as many resources as possible to meet whatever their goals are.
Yeah, exactly.
So tell me a little bit more. Let's talk a little bit about policy as it relates to teaming. So what does our policy say about CFTMs? Is there guidance about when or how often they should be occurring?
Yeah, so CFTMs should regularly occur throughout the life of a case, both a foster care case and a family preservation case. I will plug that it's in Chapter 16 of the policy manual. And if you look at the policy, you can really see the outline of when the meeting should occur. We also have meetings that don't occur on that timeline, right? Like there might be a placement CFTM that's needed and it's not on the initial or 25-day or 6-month mark. It's really when it's most needed. And I think we need a combination of both. We need to look at policy and say, we have to hold this meeting because this child has, you know, come into care. But we also need case managers and supervisors and CFTM staff who can think critically about times that they're needed, not just on that timeline.
Yeah. So how would you know if you're off the timeline, how would you know when to call a special CFTM?
Yeah, I think anytime, like when we discussed earlier, when maybe the family's having a challenge or the child is having a challenge and you're not the only person that can solve the issue, right? Like when you think about bringing, and as a case manager, I say that, right? Like if I'm a case manager and my family's struggling and I think, man, this is all on my shoulders to figure this out. When you call a CFTM, it's not just on your shoulders, right? Yeah. It's group decision-making. And it could be that like the placement's not stable, or maybe the family's struggling and they need an intensive in-home service, or maybe a medical change has happened, right? Like a medication change or an education issue, like an IEP needs to be followed up on. So really it could be anything from placement to health and well-being and anything in between, anytime there's a big decision that needs to be made.
That's so good. So I really, as a case manager, could use a CFTM anytime I need that group decision-making.
Yeah.
I can just call one.
Exactly.
Yeah. That's really cool. So share with us some of the outcome data. So when we started back at the beginning, we talked about how if CFTMs or if teaming is done well and it's done right, that it affects so many different outcomes for our children and families. So let's talk a little bit about some of the outcome data that we've seen from implementation of teaming in South Carolina.
Yeah, so we have quantitative and qualitative data, right, with our CFTM model. And each child and family team meeting, there's a survey link that's distributed to all of the team members. So it could, you know, families, case managers, providers. So we gather data on 18 different questions, and then we determine how the team members experience the CFTM and whether they felt heard and respected and supported. And so from that data, the last quarter, we had 89% of team members who felt supported and that their input was valuable during the meeting. 87% felt that even though they may not agree with the agency's concerns, they understood them and they felt heard. 91% of the team members felt that their facilitator really helped to keep everyone on track and really thinking about the child rather than blaming and shaming. And 81% of team members said they completely would recommend a CFTM to a family involved with the agency.
Wow, that's pretty great data. If 81%, so 8 out of 10 families would recommend being engaged in a CFTM.
Yeah, really that makes cool. me excited.
Yeah, that is exciting.
And of course, there's national data to support CFTMs too, but we also have really promising data about pre-removal CFTMs. And we've implemented these pre-removal CFTMs when there's a family preservation case and we think that we might have to file an ex parte or some kind of order to have the child removed from the home. And they actually have a 69% success rate in the immediate removal of the child. So
That's
bringing
amazing.
That team together, like you were thinking of an example earlier, bringing that team together instead of removing the child, right? Like it doesn't always prevent the removal, but getting everybody's heads together before we have to make that move has been very successful.
Wow, that's awesome. So 69% prevention of entry into foster care for families who participated in a pre-removal CFTM.
Yeah.
That's really powerful. So that's 69% of families. I'm just going to recap it for audience because that's really powerful. 69% of children and families who, because they had a CFTM before the point of decision was made to come into foster care, they didn't have to experience the trauma that comes with foster care entry. and they were instead able to be stabilized in their home with other services.
Yeah, and that was only 3 months of data.
Wow.
And so for 47 cases that prevented the removal, and it can't be just one child in each of those. So yeah, at least, right, like over 50 kids in 3 months
wow,
were diverted from entering foster care.
Wow, so that's so powerful.
Yeah.
That's really being family-centered in action, right? Yeah. Drawing on the family strengths, bringing that team and that village together, and then having the department's resources to be able to supplement the family's needs with services to just strengthen and stabilize.
Yeah, and I wanted to share just a few comments from the survey too.
Absolutely.
One kin caregiver said, "This whole experience has been more positive with this group of DSS workers than any other experience I've had. I really felt included as a kin caregiver every step of the way, and I really feel like they care about my child." And I know we have so many kids with kin, and it makes me think this is one way to show them that we're here to support them and that we have resources and services available to find solutions.
So. Yeah, that's really beautiful. So CFTMs really do have a massive impact, and they can improve outcomes for children and families. They can make families feel more supported, and they can be used at all levels and stages of the system. It seems like teaming really embodies our guiding principles and visions and our values in the GPS practice model in a way that just encompasses everything together.
Yeah, I think so. And I think, like I said, they all work together, but you can't do one without the other, right? So yeah, you can't assess and then not bring a plan together with the team. And you can't have a team meeting without the assessment, right? And you can't have, so these things all work together. And I'm really honored to be a part of all of this. So.
That's really cool. You've given us all of this amazing information about teaming, what they are, how we do them, and why they're important. So where can our listeners go to learn more about CFTMs and their implementation in South Carolina?
Yeah, so each region in our state has a CFTM team. And that team includes a supervisor, a coach, several CFTM facilitators, and an admin assistant. So the CFTM coaches have a really special role, right? They're here to support the county offices with building these facilitation skills. So they can support case managers and supervisors with facilitating these meetings so they can do it together and really build towards that certification in child and family teaming. They also can come out to county offices and support with presentations on their data and support with teaming in general. And then we also have facilitators that in each region that are really dedicated to foster care CFTMs throughout the life of the case. But they can also be called for other CFTMs, like a special call or a placement CFTM when it's necessary.
Mm-hmm.
We also have CFTM policy in our policy manual. Like I said before, chapter 16, which is special topics. So you can access that policy with the timeline, the work aid, and some other resources. And I'm really excited that we have on our LMS system the first module of our CFTM training. And it's self-paced, so you can go on LMS anytime and access that training. And then if you would like to have a CFTM coach come out to your office for a training or a refresher, they're always willing to help with anything that you have with teaming.
That's so great. So there's a lot of resources really wrapped around our frontline staff to help them figure out more about teaming and how it can apply in their cases. So I heard you say we've got the whole regional CFTM team, right? But specifically the coach that can really be an asset to learning more about CFTMs. We've got the policy and the work aid, and then we've also got training in LMS, all geared at helping us learn more about how to use CFTM in practice.
Yeah, and I think anytime you have a question or a thought or any feedback, I'm really willing and open to hearing how it's going in your county, what's going well, what's not going well. I think we're all, you know, nobody's perfect. And so we all have changes and improvements we can make. And I am ready and willing to hear any of that feedback.
Yeah, that's great, Lauren. I think that's such a valuable point too, because I think a lot of times in child welfare, we focus on getting everything perfect, right? And that's such an unrealistic expectation to set for ourselves, when really we could just focus on progress, right? Just continual improvement. And when we have initiatives, right, that we implement, we should always take a continuous quality improvement lens towards it, knowing that we don't have to get things right the first time, that there are always going to be adjustments that we can make, right? That tracking and adjustment that we talk about in our GPS practice model, that helps us get to the best product, but it's going to take all of us to provide feedback to make sure it's working the best it can.
Yeah, I'm a recovering type A, right? So I think when I look back on the CFTM program, I thought that we had to have it all figured out in the first year. And when you look at other states who are implementing CFTMs statewide, it took them 10 years to really have this embedded in their practice at all levels. And I think it's really a really fair thing to bring up, Emily, to really care about yourself and say, hey, you don't have to have this all figured out tomorrow, right? Like, we can build on what we've done and really look at it from a strengths-based perspective, right? So I think we should be easy on ourselves with these implementation efforts.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I think if we all remember that we got into this work to be, take it back to the beginning, right, to be advocates for change, and that our entire goal is just to do the best we can for children and families, then we're on the right path, right? And we don't have to be perfect all the time.
Exactly.
Love that. So this has been such an amazing conversation. Thank you so much for joining us and for talking about all things teaming today, Lauren. To sum up our conversation, I'd love to hear from you, if you could share in one sentence, why child and family teaming, or teaming in general, is integral to our goal of transforming the way that we work with families.
I think CFTMs can change the trajectory of a case. And by putting the child and family at the center of every decision we make, we're doing the absolute best we can and thinking about solutions that really fit for the family. And so I think that if you look at data, and I know you just said one sentence, that you would see, right, that cases that have had regular child and family team meetings have better outcomes.
Yeah.
Right.
So, I love it. Yeah. I love it. So sum it all up. Cases with teaming involved, teaming at all levels, have better outcomes.
That's right. Yeah.
I love it. Perfect. Well, thank you so much for your time and expertise today, Lauren. It's been so enlightening to be able to discover more about teaming and its role in improving outcomes for our children and families who are involved with child welfare. And thank you to all of our listeners for joining us for another episode of the Driving Sustainable Success in Child Welfare podcast. If you like what you heard, please like, follow, and subscribe. And until next time, I'm your host, Emily Madeer. And remember, you are valued, you are important, and you are making a difference.
Thank you for joining us for the Driving Sustainable Success in Child Welfare podcast, hosted by the South Carolina Department of Social Services. If you like what you heard, please follow and subscribe to the show. And until next time, remember, policies, mandates, and regulations will come and go. But successful, sustainable change is the result of thoughtful and passionate people collectively striving daily to improve the experiences and outcomes for all.